from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny. In this hour of Forum, whales. Close human interaction with the world's largest living animals is extremely rare. The photographer and conservationist Bryant Austin made it his life's work after unexpectedly finding himself eye-to-eye with a humpback whale and her calf a decade ago in the South Pacific. His life-sized, high-resolution photos of whales have been exhibited in countries that still practice whaling, including Japan and Norway. A collection of his work is now available in his book, Beautiful Whale. He'll join us for the hour, and we'll get started right after this. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Whales are the largest living animals on Earth, also very difficult to photograph because of their size and where they live. In 2004, an unexpected close encounter with a humpback mother and her calf in the South Pacific led conservationist Bryant Austin to make photographing whales his life work. Today, he creates high-resolution, life-size photographs of whales that appear in exhibitions and now in a book titled Beautiful Whale. And Bryant Austin joins us for the hour. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Scott.
And also joining us to talk about those amazing creatures, as well as dolphins and porpoises, Izzy Shapaniak. He's a marine biologist with the Golden Gate Cetacean Research. He's also been a naturalist for the Oceanic Society since 1982. Good to have you with us as well.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Let me begin with you, Bryant. Take us back to that day in 2004 when you encountered those whales. Was that the year? Was it 2004? Had that encounter, that sort of unexpected encounter?
Yeah, it was 2004, and it was a time where I had made the decision to give up this work. I was trying to create photography that reaches a wider audience. People have no interest in whales. And photographing whales underwater is incredibly uninspiring to me. The encounters are incredible. Every photo I would take does not recreate the sensation you experience, nor did any underwater photo from anybody that I've seen. And so these two whales, in a way, shined a light on what was missing, what I could offer.
And describe what happened. What was the circumstance? Where were you?
Well, I was just floating at the surface on snorkel. I was in the South Pacific in the Kingdom of Tonga. We were probably in 100 feet of visibility, underwater visibility. I was observing a mother and calf resting. And the calf decided to come up for a close inspection, and this calf appeared to be what was on a head-on collision course. You know, he's a little over 2 tons, probably 5 weeks old. And I remember seeing him churn at the last moment, and I used a fisheye lens, so it makes him look very small in the viewfinder, but I knew he was close, so I was worried he would bump my camera. So I lowered the camera, and before my eyes, I was completely taken aback by the sight of this belly button going right by my face.
Just sort of enveloped your whole field of
view. My whole field of view. And I'd never been that close to a whale before. I never would dare swim that close to them. And none have ever approached me that close underwater. And so you could see their true colors. You could see all the fine detail and the subtle tones. These are all the elements that make them real, especially in photography. And so he kept moving by. I could see his skin and musculature move and flex over his frame as he powered down his fluke one more time. And his 5 foot wide tail went right by my face by about a foot. And he's only, like I said, 5 weeks old. And it's just humbling to me, this mind-body awareness they have to be so careful not to hurt us accidentally. It's unusual. I haven't seen that in any other species. And so I just floated there at the surface trying to reconcile what I had experienced. I was ready to give up. I've done this for years, great sacrifice. I didn't have the answers anymore. I thought, well, what was that? You know, was there something there? And as the wheels were turning in my mind, I just felt a single tap on my shoulder, and I knew it was too solid to be human. And I just felt this dread as I turned to look over my shoulder, and I was eye to eye with the mother. And she had reached out with her 15-foot-long, 2-ton pectoral fin and touched me with the very tip of it. And she could easily have broken my back if she wanted to, even by accident, you know, just not gauging it correctly. And I was just shaking from her restraint. And I ended up in between her and her calf, which is something I don't recommend. She was looking into my eyes, and for the first time I saw the calm, mindful gaze of an adult whale looking into my own eyes, and instantly saw what I could offer the world. Just these calm moments, the calm, mindful gaze of a whale looking into the camera. I saw it with my own eyes, so that was very important.
And, you said up until that point you've been frustrated and, mm-hmm. and felt unable to really capture what it was you wanted to.
I struggled for years to try to recreate those sensations you experience when you're with a whale, and when you're with them underwater, above water. It's very challenging.
And the difficulty is the equipment, the size, the inability to get close. I mean, what are some of the things that made it so hard?
The real challenge for all of us in my field is time. We all have to make a profit. We all have to survive. And so we don't spend enough time because it's very expensive. It's $500 to $2,000 a day to be with a whale and do this work.
Because of where they are.
Where they are. They live in a hostile environment. You know, we need life support out there. We need a boat. We need a skipper and a deckhand, you know, to keep us safe. And so I just don't think we've seen much yet. You know, whale photography has been around for 40 years, but I think we're still scratching the surface. And the big obstacle is time. And that's what I was running up against, because for 6 years I was photographing whales, dolphins, and porpoises here on the Monterey Bay and decoupled myself from the pressure, the financial pressure to make a profit. I wanted to be separate from that and just explore and learn. And really my mantra was, I don't know. I just want to be here and open myself up to inspiration beyond my imagination. And I was ready to quit. I just thought maybe this isn't a good approach.
And you found a benefactor, didn't you? I mean, how did you – I mean, once that encounter happened, I mean, you still had to support yourself and find the money?
Not initially. I trying to reconcile that inspiration was very difficult. I spent a year and a half trying to continue pursuing this idea of a life-size photograph and also keeping my day job. And that was just making me miserable, just incredibly depressed. And I remember my therapist telling me something none of us want to hear. She simply said, she looked at me one day and just said, I don't know how to help you. And we sat there together and in silence, I was stunned. And then I just looked up at her and said, I need to quit my job. And I made that big leap, sold everything I own. I mean, my home, my car, cashed out my retirement. I raised enough funding for 125 days of field work across two field seasons to begin practicing and learning how to do this. It was a huge leap and it was scary, but I felt really at peace with that decision. It's hard to describe.
And the kinds of photos, these life-size photographs, I mean, what does it take to put something like that together?
Wow.
I mean, it's huge.
Yeah, I had to learn. So those 124 days was all about learning and making a lot of mistakes. I had many opportunities where whales would come up close to me, but I could share so many examples of the mistakes I made.
Give us one.
I had an incredible encounter during that time where two whales swam right up to me. They swam underneath me. They immediately did a 180 and came right back, almost on a head-on collision course, as I mentioned earlier. But this time, this whale moved away about 6 feet, came right in front of me. This whale was so close that his 9-foot-long pectoral fin went right underneath my body as I composed portraits or photographs, composite photos. So I'm only photographing about 6 feet of the whale at a time. And what I learned from that, it was an incredible encounter, should have been a beautiful life-size mosaic, but the sun was in the wrong direction. I had forgotten where the light was. And now what I do, I always face where the light is most ideal. And this means whales may come up and inspect my feet. I cannot turn to face them. I have to just wait and hope that they come around and come meet me eye to eye. And at times I feel as though our eyes gravitate towards each other. So there's a lot of trust. And it's just one of the many lessons I've learned over time.
And Izzy Schipanik, let me bring you into this. How do whales and their behavior, how does it differ from, say, harbor porpoises and dolphins, which you also study?
Well, harbor porpoises and bottlenose dolphins are pretty much coastal animals. They stay, the coastal bottlenose dolphin stays within a mile of shore, and harbor porpoises generally stay fairly close to shore. We've seen them maybe about 10 miles out, but that's here in the Bay Area. The difference between, they both have a variety of behaviors, but it's a difference of degree and size. When a porpoise or a dolphin surface, it's a quick little surface. You see the head, you see the dorsal fin, you see the flukes or the tail. With whales, it seems like forever between the time you see the spout or the blow of the animal, then you see the dorsal fin, then you see the tail stalk, then you see the tail. And during this whole period, I mean, you're just awed by the size of the animal, and that this animal could be so graceful, like Brian was talking about, his experience with close encounters. You can get the same kind of experience from a boat. Mm-hmm. And it's just as exciting the first time you see it as it is the 100th or 1,000th time you see it. You're just overwhelmed by how graceful these large animals could be. And with the difference between the whales and the dolphins is it's the speed at which they move.
And in terms of, I mean, you know, I've been on boats where dolphins have come right up to the boat and they seem to want to communicate and play and those kinds of things. Whales, not so much.
Well, I've had experiences where whales would come towards the boat and, for lack of any other term, play with the boat. There was a time in the Sea of Cortez, we were just watching this humpback whale, and the humpback whale came towards our boat, which we had stopped because we didn't want to affect the behavior. We had stopped and were sitting still in the water. Humpback whale came over to us. It spy hopped. It brought its head out of the water and looked at us. It kind of slid right back down into the water. Mm. And then it began swimming around the boat from front to back and from side to side. And each time as it would go from one side to the other, it would poke its head up. It would spy hop and look at the people on the boat. And for a while, it was really funny. In the old days, you saw cartoons where people would run from one side of the boat to the other, and they exaggerated the effect of that. You see the boat lean one way or the other. People on the boat were doing that as the whale moved from one side to the other. They just run from the port side to the starboard side. And that whale was doing something with the boat. It's not something that a whale would do, just come up back and forth. It was engaging the boat, if not the people on the boat. And the most interesting thing is right before it swam off, it was on one side of the boat, and it just turned on its longitudinal axis. It just rolled over and over, flapping its flukes as it went. So you do get some experiences like that. And with a dolphins and porpoises, the behavior of bow riding is actually a transferred behavior, because originally these animals, the dolphins and porpoises, would ride the bow wave of the whales swimming in the water. Hmm. And the same kind of pressure wave created by the whale swimming through water is what the ships are doing now. So I've seen dolphins bow riding the wake of a blue whale, of a humpback whale. And it's I can't think of anything else to say, but it's play.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Brian Austin, what based on what you see out there, how are you feeling about the environment that the whales in particular are in these days? What kinds of threats are there? Are things in any way improving for them?
It's a very depressing subject. You know, it's like whales are really my focus of artistic study, and you have to become an advocate because you see what's happening to them. I'm sure there are examples of things improving for some whale species, but I just feel everything is precarious right now. I mean, there are species such as the blue whale and the fin whale, the largest creatures ever to exist on Earth, that number less than 2%. And there are some that are 20%, such as the sperm whales. And then there are some that seem to be doing really well, like minke whales and gray whales, at least here off our coast. Excuse me.
And the biggest threat is what?
I think the number one biggest threat, it's one that we could also address and we could do something about individually, I think is fisheries bycatch. More than 300,000 whales, dolphins, and porpoises drown in commercial fishing gear every year, and that's a conservative estimate from 10 years ago.
300,000.
Yeah, that's I believe that's 12 times more animals dying than at the height of whaling in the mid 20th century. It's a staggering number. Think about it. I mean, that's 3 million that have died in the last 10 years, and that's for our love of seafood, and we're all responsible. And I've done a lot of work in exhibiting my work in countries that hunt whales, but whaling is really less than 1% of what's killing them. It's really our lifestyle.
And is it inadvertent, or is it just sort of, you know, I mean, it's they're not obviously trying to catch those.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No, it is inadvertent. It's very inconvenient for the fishermen. It damages their gear. Sometimes they lose their gear. You'll have humpback whales haul down gear from Alaska, crab pots, and bring down the gear to Hawaii 3,000 miles to the south. So it's not ideal for anyone involved.
Yeah. Talking with Bryant Austin, a photographer and author of the book A Beautiful Whale. And by the way, his work is going to be on display at the Museum of Monterey through September 2nd. He's also going to be appearing at the Monterey Bay Aquarium on June 8th and 9th as part of their World Oceans Day celebration. Also with us for the hour, Izzy Shapognak, a marine biologist with the Golden Gate Cetacean Research Organization. And he's also worked as a naturalist for the Ocean Society since Oceanic Society since 1982. And you, Izzy, we were talking before the show about the reappearance of dolphins and harbor porpoises in the Bay Area, in the San Francisco Bay. What tell us about that. What accounts for that?
Well, one interesting thing about this story, it's a lot of stories we're hearing about wildlife in general are sad stories, problems with one species or another. But this is actually a success story. Prior to the Second World War, harbor porpoises were seen in San Francisco Bay in large enough numbers that people made note of it. But starting in the Second World War, there were a couple events that occurred that kind of pushed the harbor porpoises out. One was just a lot of very, very noisy boat traffic. There was a degradation of the quality of the bay as the war effort began.
Ship repairs,
things like that, ecology was not foremost on anybody's mind during that period of time. And probably the major factor was that from Crissy Field across to the coast of Marin, there was a submarine net that was laid out. And it was basically from the surface of the water all the way down to the seafloor bed in San Francisco Bay, which pretty much prohibited any animal the size of a harbor porp, which was just about human size, maybe 4.5 to 5 feet, maybe about 150 pounds. So that's what led to them leaving San Francisco Bay. And we've learned that animals have cultures that they pass on from one generation to another. And I'm talking anthropomorphically, but where the food is, where good places are to hang out. And after the submarine net was taken, the short-lived harbor porpoise, whose lifespan is usually at most around 15 years, you had four generations basically in the 60 years between the Second World War and when we started seeing them in good numbers in San Francisco Bay. And so with the quality of the bay improving, with the abundant food resources, and right now herring and anchovies are quite abundant in San Francisco Bay, harbor porpoises have found a place that they once occupied that they can go back to and occupy now. And as of this week, we have identified about 600 different harbor porpoise individuals that have at one time or another come into San Francisco Bay since 2008.
And the occasional whale.
And the occasional whale, yes.
What people go down, it's become a tourist attraction down at Pier 39 to see there's seals.
The California sea lions.
Sea lions. And, of course, the whole thing with Humphrey, the whale. And I mean, what kinds of – those are sort of teachable moments, I guess, for people. But how do folks in your line of work think of that when for one reason or another, a large animal like that is suddenly in the news?
Well, we've had quite a number of gray whales enter the San Francisco Bay in the last – couple dozen years. We have at least three or four, maybe even up to half a dozen gray whales come into and out of San Francisco Bay. They're not using it for feeding or anything else that we can tell at this time. But they are spending time in San Francisco Bay, maybe exploring the bay. They swim in, and most of them swim right out. It's just really interesting that these animals are coming into the bay. And so what we're doing is we're trying to find – one of the things that we do in studying whales and dolphins is we try to identify individual animals. So what we're trying to discover is, are these the same animals coming into San Francisco Bay and leaving San Francisco Bay? Or is it just individuals that kind of wander into the bay and wander back out?
Yeah. And Bryant, coming back to your work and the photography, you said earlier that the equipment was not really an issue, that it mm-hmm. was there were other factors, but you know, doing a life-sized mm-hmm. photograph of such a huge animal, I mean, you do have to have a certain number of pixels and that sort of thing. Talk about the equipment that you do use and what the limitations are, or you know, how you've overcome that.
Yeah, I think once you achieve the goal of providing time, sufficient time for everything, then you can focus on technology and the techniques. And really, I use a 50-megapixel camera. It has a 80 to 100-millimeter telephoto portrait lens. And what I've learned over time is I have to wait for a whale to come up to me. I float motionless. I just observe. And 1% of the time out of all my experiences in the field, I'll have a whale come up and initiate a close inspection. And so they come up to about 6 feet, and at that distance, I'm only photographing 5 feet of their body at a time. And I found that even at 10 feet, if you have a 50-megapixel sensor, it's meaningless. There's no technology you can bring to the table to make this photo life-size. In the end, it's really up to the whale. It's the proximity that their willingness to come so close that makes it all possible. You could actually take incredibly beautiful photos of a whale with a point-and-shoot digital camera in a little underwater housing. It's up to them. So if they come close enough to that little point-and-shoot, on their terms, you can have a calm, mindful expression in their eye and take a stunning photograph.
But when you're making a photograph that is life-size,
yes.
you're taking multiple images and putting them together.
Yeah, it depends on the encounter. I've had encounters last anywhere from 4 minutes to 6 hours. And the six-hour encounter, I composed over 300 photographs. Again, these are in 5 foot wide sections. I'll take very close up portraits of the dorsal, the top of the whale, the bottom of the whale, this under the surface of the water, and the whale's reflection in the surface of the water. So, the more time they give me, the more I can explore the aesthetics, and I'm really just compiling really technically sound raw data to bring together, and then I'll bring this all together into Photoshop. And these are massive files. For the listeners that are into computers, these are 60 gigabyte files. They use 400 gigabytes of memory, probably have 300 layers, different photos, different adjustment layers. So these are daunting files. And every time I come back with a successful mosaic where I have the raw data, I have to build a new computer every time.
Wow,
they keep getting bigger, yeah.
Yeah, and the cover photograph on this book, "Beautiful Whale," is quite extraordinary. Tell us about it. But you're right in the middle of the photograph, the middle of the cover, more or less, is the eye of this whale.
Yeah, that's a humpback whale calf, probably 5 or 6 weeks old. We named him Beethoven. He's become the icon of my work indirectly through all my collaborations. The shows in Norway and Japan had Beethoven as the icon. The publisher loved this photo And so we put him on the cover. And this was a photo that was just hiding in my folder somewhere. And I couldn't make him life-size. So I just thought, nope, he's out of here.
And what do you get? We're just coming up to a break here quickly. But what do you get out of looking? When you're looking into the eye of a whale, what are you seeing?
There's a connection. And it's something that we can't scientifically measure yet. But there's a knowing that there's a consciousness there, an intelligence, an awareness.
Sensitivity is what I get from looking at the photograph.
Yeah, the sensitivity also comes through just in the way they move in such close proximity to me, not touching me or touching me, which I don't encourage.
Okay. Much more to talk about whales in this hour with Bryant Austin and Izzy Shapognak. And if you'd like to join the conversation, tell us your own experiences of photographing sea life or going out on a whale-watching boat. I did that last summer in Cape Cod. Pretty extraordinary. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. 866-733-6786. You can also email your comments and questions to forum@kqed.org. or leave a comment on our Facebook page. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this morning. In this hour, we're talking about whales along with dolphins and porpoises. My guests, Bryant Austin, a photographer and author of the book Beautiful Whale, and Izzy Shaponiak. He is a marine biologist, has studied whales, of course, and also dolphins and harbor porpoises here in the Bay Area and elsewhere. If you want to join us, the number to call is 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org. During the break and just before the break, I was mentioning that we went whale watching this past last summer in Cape Cod, and wow, extraordinary numbers of whales. It was, I think, maybe September, late August. And Izzy, you were saying that you too have been out there. We think it may have been the same company. What's the experience? How is it different whale watching on the East Coast versus out here?
Well, to me, one of the biggest things is we can see right whales in New England. Where there's about 400 right whales in the North Atlantic. A lot of them spend time in the New England area.
When you say right whales, what do you mean?
Well, it's called the right whale, and it's kind of an unusual name. It was called right whale because it was the right whale to kill for the whalers. It was big. It had a lot of oil. It had a lot of baleen. And they use baleen for things like corset stays and combs and other things like that. And also, when it died, it floated. So when they would kill the animal, it would float to the surface. It would be easier to drag them back either to a ship or back to land. So that's why it's got its name, because it was a good whale to go after. It was monetarily rewarding, and it was also easy to recover.
And these are humpbacks or gray whales? What are they?
Well, they're baleen whales, the right whales, and also in New England we had I saw minky whales.
So I'm sorry, just so right whale is actually the name of
it's the name of a baleen whale.
Of
the
yes. Baleen whale. Okay, right. Got it.
And one of the differences, like between the right whale and a humpback whale, is humpback whales have throat grooves, and so do blue whales, fin whales. Mm. Whereas the right whale does not have throat grooves, but what it does is has a really, really big mouth. So right whales can have baleen that could be 16 feet long, whereas something like a blue whale or a fin whale, it's more 6 to 8 feet long.
Hmm. And just in general, as I mentioned during the break, I've been whale watching in Monterey Bay. Was, you know, of course, you never tell what you're going to find. I mean, it's not like going to the zoo. But the experience on the East Coast was so much better. Is that typical, do you think?
Actually, not. It's all dependent upon weather.
Timing. And
because when I went out in off Cape Cod, we never got around Cape Cod into the open Atlantic. We were actually in Cape Cod Bay, so it was well protected. If we hadn't seen whales there, we would have gone out around the Cape and into the much, much rougher water. So we just happened to be very lucky then. But we have days here where it's absolutely still. I've gone to the Farallon Islands where it was like a bathtub in terms of swell. And so it's just the day you pick to go out. We could have good days. We could have bad days. And it's the same on the East Coast. You happen to pick a really good day. I happen to pick a good day inside the bay, but it wouldn't have been very good if I went out into the Atlantic.
Yeah. And just in general, in terms of the population, it varies by year. It's not going to be – you're not going to see more whales in one place or another where they generally live or not.
Well, as a rule, with right whales, we have very few – in the Pacific Ocean, we have about 100, if not less. On the East Coast, we have about 400 animals, and they go to feed in large numbers between Cape Cod and Stellwagen Bank, which is about 30, 40 miles offshore. So for that, yes. With humpback whales, we have quite a large number of humpback whales here in the Pacific Ocean going up and down the coast of California, numbering about 5,000 animals. We see blue whales here. It's one of the best places to see blue whales is along the coast of California, Monterey Bay, and here by the Farallon Islands. They don't have as many blue whales in the Atlantic Ocean, and they generally go up towards Canada to feed, whereas we have animals, blue whales, that feed all along the California coast on up into Alaska and Russian waters.
Yeah. There's also been reports in the last few weeks about feeding. Is it the orca orca whales?
It's the killer whale.
The killer whale. And that's just that just happens in nature. It's not as big a threat, I suppose, as the fisheries nets, but it's disturbing to hear about and to watch, I guess, huh?
Well, killer whales are actually named because they kill whales. They originally described as whale killers, and somehow the name got switched around to killer whales. But that's actually a natural behavior. There are some killer whales that will feed only on fish. There are other killer whales that will feed on fish or marine mammals. And there are some killer whales that will just feed on marine mammals, whales, dolphins, porpoises, and the seals or sea lions.
Yeah. Again, we're talking, obviously, about whales this hour. And if you want to join us, the number 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email your comments to forum at kqed.org. And we will try to get some of those as well. Brian Austin, you said that you had exhibited some of your photographs of whales in countries where whaling still happens, Norway and Japan. Mm-hmm. What kind of reaction do you get there?
Well, at first I didn't know what to expect, and I was really nervous. And I had partnered with NGOs working in these countries. One was the oldest NGO. It's a 150-year animal rights activist organization, and they've gave me a 4 or 5 page document on all the questions that will be asked of me that are contentious and provocative and, you know, highly polarizing. It's been their experience for over 20 years. And what we discovered, especially in interfacing with the media and sharing the work with the media, is that none of those questions were asked. We just drew out curiosity and fascination and had a whole new dialogue about whales. And really the basic thing was like, how can you be so close to them and they're not hurting you? How come, you know, they're not killing you. and I could talk about them as individuals. You know, many of the whales I work with are named by biologists, and I could tell stories. And so it was a really heartwarming and hopeful experience, you know, promising experience.
Did whalers come to the exhibit?
I met whalers, yep. And it was interesting, you know, because the journalist brought whalers to one of my exhibits, and I met them. And these were gentlemen from the 60s who hunted in the Southern Ocean and were responsible for wiping out most of the blue whales down there. And you know, we were very respectful and with each other, and I could tell that they were kind of speechless because they see these photographs, and I'm telling stories about a whale rubbing his head against my body and rolling over and coming up to look at me with his – this is a sperm whale – with his lower jaw open just underneath my body as I'm composing these photographs. And it gave him pause. I mean, I'm not – focusing on inspiring whalers to think differently, but it was just a wonderful experience to do that. And
really, what were some of those provocative questions that you were prepared for?
This was 5 years ago. So it gets into a point counterpoint situation where we talk about the ethics and you know, we talk about the dialogue that happens a lot. The point of contention is humanely killing a whale. And it's difficult to kill a whale quickly. There's a lot of suffering, and it can take, in Norway, maybe 20 minutes to a half hour or more to die. And it's an incredibly painful death. There's other points of, you know, contention in the debate, but I think that was the main one that stood out in my mind.
Yeah, you said you weren't there to change their minds, but certainly you wouldn't mind if that came about.
No, I was there to learn and then to introduce myself as an artist who's not offensive, who's not going to tell you how to think and feel, and I just want you to explore your own thoughts and feelings.
And there aren't that many countries that do whaling anymore, right? I mean, Russia used to. They don't do it anymore.
Commercial whaling, I believe, is limited to Iceland, Norway, and Japan.
Yeah. And do they see it just in completely different – they see it as an economic necessity or
I'm sure Izzy has some thoughts on that as well. But really, at this stage of the game, I see it – it's a waning industry, and it's also being prolonged by polarization. You know, outsiders telling them what to do, and you can't do this, and you know you're horrible for doing this, and it polarizes, and it prolongs this whole experience.
Yeah, Izzy Shpanek, what would you add?
Well, I agree with Brian. The method of killing is very long, drawn out affair, and so we know that the whales are suffering for a great period of time. You know, like with Japan and the Aboriginal whalers, I mean, this has been part of their culture for years and years and years. And you kind of look at the Aboriginal, the subsistence whaling, a lot different because they're actually collecting the whales And that, for example, in Alaska, North Slope, who go after the bowhead whales, the Inuits up there, I mean, that's their source of food. They don't have farms that they can go to the way we can get food. We can grow farm. We could grow some kind of produce in our backyards. This is their backyard, and this is what they're doing. In Japan, there's actually a campaign in Japan where they go out and collect the whales and give the food away to get a taste of whales for the school children as well. So
what do you think of that? I mean, what's the purpose of that?
Just so they support the whaling industry and support Japan whaling. And they have mixed feelings there because now eating whales is not as important to their lifestyle as it was, for example, the period after World War II, where that was a major source of protein for them. It's a lot different right now.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the phones. And again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. And let's go to Art in Sonoma County. Welcome.
Hi, hello. My name is Art, and I've had several great experiences with whales. They're so magical. The first, with several friends in 1981, we drove from Malibu to Guerrero Negro, halfway down the Baja, camped near Scammon's Lagoon. And I put on my wetsuit, and I walked about a quarter mile out into the water in the muddy bottom, close to the drop-off, and stayed there for about an hour and a half while I got to watch a mother and a calf. And I really didn't want to come back, but the sun was going down, so I for about the ensuing 15 years, I regularly would kayak in Malibu, living in an apartment near the beach, and several great sightings. But the most incredible thing happened about 5 years ago up here. I moved to Petaluma in 2000, and have some long kayaks, but I had my folding hard shell kayak, which opens up to less than 10 feet. And I launched in Marshall, and I had paddled down to this marker buoy halfway out in the channel near Tony's restaurant, Marshall. And there was a big adult that was just scraping itself up against the marker buoy. And I'm about 50 feet away, and I let my drill self-drift closer and closer and closer. Finally, I got about 20 feet away, and I thought to myself, this is enough. And the whale kept coming up and looking at me, coming up and looking at me. Finally, it turned, came straight toward me, and about 5 feet away from the bow, went straight under the kayak, drew me down with a little bit of the water pressure, and then left. And it was just both thrilling and scary and exciting, and it was as if the whale had communicated to me, is that close enough for you, dude?
Brian Austin, I'm sure you've had similar kinds of experiences.
It brings back a lot of memories. I find the closer they come to you, the more real they become, the more evident. And, you know, and those are very special experiences. They're gifts. And, you know, I think I've calculated that less than 0.001% of the human population will know encounters such as the one this gentleman described. And it's really a tragedy because they inspire so much in us when our paths cross.
Yeah. Art, as you you describe that story to other people, what kind of reaction do you get?
There's always a smile, and typically there's kind of a bit awestruck. Most people don't say anything until they speak. There's a moment of silence. And when I tell that story to someone who's a naturalist, invariably they say, well, you were very lucky.
Yeah.
I also want to add something about the Scammon's Lagoon. You may be aware that in the 90s, Mitsubishi wanted to build a salt plant there.
Where is that exactly?
Scammon's Lagoon.
Where?
It's halfway down the Baja Peninsula.
Okay.
And it's an area where they go to calve and nurse. And there was such a hue and cry that I'm proud to say I was part of. There was a boycott of Mitsubishi cars and other products. They walked away from it.
Yeah.
They didn't build the salt plant.
Yeah. Well, obviously, people like you, Art, who had a close encounter, have very strong feelings about it. But to what extent would you say, and I'll put this to either one of you guys here, do people identify with whales in the same way that they do, say, with dolphins? and protecting dolphins? Do you think there's a difference? Because more, I think more people come in contact with dolphins and maybe have fuzzier feelings about dolphins than they do about whales. Brian?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think dolphins are just more accessible. And whales, they're not as accessible. They're not as a part of our consciousness, our awareness. And so that is a challenge.
Making them seem a little more, being able to identify with them.
Yeah, and that's something I work on through my work and just trying to, I want to give people a memory of what a whale really looks like and try to give them a sense of what it's like to swim along the length of their body.
Yeah. Well, Art, thanks very much for the call. Are you still out there looking for whales in your kayak?
I'm going out kayaking every weekend in Salmon's Lagoon. It's remarkable. It's special. And even if I don't see anything, it's always a great time.
Yeah. Mm. When you tell that story to people, does anyone say, you're making that up?
Never.
You're a good storyteller. Thanks very much. Good luck to you. Let's go back to the phones a little further up the coast there. Santa Rosa, Ron is on the line. Welcome.
Yes. Good morning.
Morning.
I enjoy your programs tremendously. I wanted to relate, my wife and I were snorkeling in Anthony Keys off of Honduras. And we went to a place where you could swim with dolphins. So I guess the unfortunate part that it was, you know, they were enclosed. You know, it wasn't a free swim, I guess. But we got into the water and immediately... two dolphins came over and swam around my wife and then picked her up, you know, just like they do, you know, at the parks, and took her for a ride, you know. And a dolphin came up to me and just met me, you know, head on, you know, nose to nose, eyes to eyes. And I stared into this dolphin's eyes that, you know, I hate to say this, seemed very real to me and human, I guess. And then the dolphin started to squeak, and we just swam around and had a little relationship, you know. But I felt, there was a connection.
Yeah, Izzy Shpaniak, what sort of intelligence are we talking about for these animals?
You know, it's really hard to define intelligence, but one of the things that we use is self-recognition or self-awareness. And a lot of the research in intelligence nowadays has to do with just that field, self-awareness, recognizing in a mirror that object in the mirror is them, mm-hmm. a particular dolphin or porpoise. And they do that with terrestrial mammals as well, elephants and things like that. But it's really clear that... these animals have a certain kind of intelligence that is above and beyond just an intelligence that allows them to survive in their habitat. I mean, what's the most intelligent animals? People often say the one that does best in its environment, but it seems to go beyond with dolphins and porpoises. And a lot of things about that is that you can get a personal connection, like the previous caller said, or this caller. And once you have that personal connection, it comes to another level.
Mm. And they're social.
They're very social, yes. We see a lot of activities. We see a lot of activities of these animals where they're helping one another, where they're playing together, they're cooperatively feeding. Humpback whales are really well known for their different feeding behaviors, where groups of humpback whales either form bubble nets and share the food or herd the food together. So there is a lot of social activity going on, both for food, for sexual activity, for teaching purposes. So there's a lot of things going on with these animals, very social, and to us they appear very smart.
All right. Well, Ron, thanks very much for the call. Let's look at some email here. Jeffrey writes, while scuba diving, I had snapped a shot of a leopard shark swimming right overhead. Exhilarating, but a little scary. Being in the real environment along with the wildlife is quite an experience. Lori writes, I'm a serious amateur photographer and was hoping to go to Baja during the calving season to do some photography. The tours are quite expensive, $2,000 to $3,000. And I wonder if you have any advice. I speak Spanish, and I wonder if it's possible to go down on my own and find a local boatman to go out into the bays to see the whales. Any advice, Brent?
I think Izzy would be the expert on for all things Baja California.
Izzy?
Well, in San Ignacio Lagoon, there are several camps there where you can drive there. You can fly down there and get a bus going into San Ignacio Lagoon. Those are not quite as costly as doing a boat trip into the lagoons. There are locals who are really into the people going out and seeing the whales. It's a source of income for them, and to them the whales are very dear. Those are good ways to do photography from the little maybe 20-foot pangas or small boats that they're using. You could stay in the camp, and like I say, it's a lot less expensive. One thing you won't be able to do, though, in San Ignacio Lagoon is get in the water with them. So you'll have a lot of boat experience, and up to and including the calves and adults coming to the boat and actually rubbing up against the boat, pushing the boat, sometimes even lifting the boat out of the water. And the reason you can't get in the water is Mexico has a very, very good program at protecting the breeding lagoons of the gray whales down there. They have a wonderful resource, and they've done an absolute great job protecting the resource that they had.
All right, 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You're listening to Forum. We're talking this hour about whales with Bryant Austin, a photographer and author of the book Beautiful Whale. His work, by the way, will be on display at the Museum of Monterey through September 2nd. He's also going to be appearing at the Monterey Bay Aquarium on June 8th and 9th as part of their World Oceans Day celebration. Also with us, Izzy Shapognak, a marine biologist with the Golden Gate Cetacean Research Organization. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio, and for more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer, in for Michael Krasny. We've got an email here from John, who writes, the description of the whale experience in the Sea of Cortez was spellbinding. The behavior of the whale during and again in parting suggests the whale had, quote, diagnosed the problem with the dead in the water boat, geolocated it, and while perhaps waving to the boat seems to me to suggest that the whale had also prescribed the cure. Time to go, start your propeller turning. Whimsical, perhaps, but only perhaps. People do ascribe all kinds of things to the behavior of animals, don't they, Izzy?
Yeah, they do, and a lot of it is because we want them to feel the same way about us as we feel about the animals. And this is particularly true with the whales and dolphins and porpoises.
And that's a good thing.
Oh, that's a great thing. That's a great thing. And one of the, you know, the more that people have contact with animals, the more documentaries they see, the more shows they see, it brings them closer and closer to these animals, and it's as a naturalist, it's really very exciting to see people see a whale in person for the very first time.
Brian, I wonder, this is a little out there, but I really like being in the water, and I swim, I play water polo, I scuba dive, feel very comfortable and relaxed in the water, and I'm sure that that's true with you. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I don't particularly believe in reincarnation, but I sometimes wonder if I was a fish, you know, in another life. I mean, do you, with these encounters that you have with these enormous animals, do you ever think about things like that?
Well, I think I find myself getting into touch with something that's in our DNA, that we are aquatic animals. We have the capacity to do amazing things in the water, and our body has the amazing ability to survive. And, you know, even blacking out from low levels of oxygen when you're free diving, it has a series of steps it does to protect you and help you become, you know, resuscitated. We are aquatic animals, and it's exciting to reconnect with that through free diving for me in particular.
Yeah, Izzy, what about you?
Well, I've always had an affinity for the ocean. I've been drawn to the ocean since I was a young child. I've always wanted to study whales. I too dive. I'm a certified scuba diver. I free dive and I surf. So I got to be in, on, or under the water all the time.
Yeah. And Brian, with these photographs, I mean, obviously you've had extraordinary contact and a chance to look at these animals up close. What has, you know, in addition to the sort of psychological impact that it has or the emotional impact, what have you learned about them as creatures in terms of, you know, the way they're built, the way they move, the way they anticipate things, that kind of stuff, their behavior?
gosh, you know, I'm kind of at a loss. You know, the more time I spend with them, they become less whale-like. I mean, they're not whales anymore. They're just something else. And it's really hard. I struggle to find the words for it, especially for that question. They're so unfamiliar, and they're even unfamiliar to me to this day. When I'm in the water with one 6 feet away who's inspecting me, it's like it's a whole new experience every time, and I'm still learning.
It's still sort of an awesome experience.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. What about you, Izzy, with not just with whales, but, the other animals you study?
Well, one of the things about being in the water with whales is they're so big, you're almost humbled to think that you're just this little speck to this large 100-foot animal. With dolphins and porpoises, I've been in the water with them, and again, it's you're just in awe of these animals and what they can do in the aquatic environment and how much better suited for the water they are than we are. And again, it's very humbling.
Yeah. Let's see if we can get one more quick phone call in here. Gloria in Hayward. Welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to say I took my daughter on one of the whale watching boats in San Francisco. And the encounter we had was that the whale came up to the boat, and I had some fear. I said, oh, no, it's going to crash the boat. But it totally was gentle. I could feel that, and it's something that we'll both never forget. And I can't imagine the actual encounter underwater with one.
Yeah.
That itself was great.
Although we should say, Bryant, don't try this at home. I mean, they can be dangerous, right?
There is a risk, and it's something that has bothered me for years as I developed the methods and techniques, and I've really had to learn to trust them and really do everything I can to be as safe as possible.
And as you said, you don't want to get between a mother and her
cat. No, not at all. You don't want to be in between any whales.
Or any wild animal, really.
Exactly.
And their parent. Okay, well, thanks to both of you very much. Bryant Austin, photographer and author of the book, A Beautiful Whale. And again, his work will be on display at the Museum of Monterey through September 2nd. He'll also be appearing at the Monterey Bay Aquarium on June 8th and 9th as part of their World Oceans Day celebration. Thanks so much for being here and for your work,
Scott,
as well. And thanks to you as well, Izzy Chapagnac, a marine biologist with Golden Gate Cetacean Research. Great to talk with you, too.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman today as well. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED, thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.